Coming up today, hotel hacks, locked-in syndrome breakthroughs, and news of the sack-like creature with no anus that may be your eldest ancestor. You're listening to episode 303 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Vicky Wollaston.
Hello.
Liat Clark.
Hello.
And Matthew Burgess.
Hello.
Hello.
Afternoon, James.
Hello. Let's just keep saying hello. No. Okay. Well, what did you learn this week, Matt Burgess?
This week? Well, actually, have any of you got any weird collections that you add to on a regular basis?
Penguins? I mean, not real ones, like teddies and toys and stuff. Yeah,
I collect objects that you've touched.
Me personally.
Mm. Yes.
Okay, this has turned dark. I'm going to move on. Harry Spurl, who is also known as Hamburger Harry, has a collection of 3,724, at least, probably a lot more by now, hamburger-related items.
I mean, it's not surprising if his parents are going to call him Hamburger Harry.
I think that's more of a nickname that he's adopted.
But he has given himself.
Probably. He has a hamburger waterbed.
What?
What?
Do we understand why and if Harry has sought any help?
Oh, I don't want to comment on this.
Well, so long as he's
Hamburglar
not,
from
so
McDonald's.
So long as he's not hurting anyone, I suppose. Leah, what did you learn this week?
I learned, just to, you know, make you all feel good, 6,000 diseases are caused by mutations in our DNA, but we only have approved therapies for 5% of those.
Oh, good.
I know. But it's okay, because technology will change this.
It's a far more serious fact than Matt Burgess's hamburgers one.
Yeah, this is actually a fact from Daisy Robinton, who is going to be speaking at Wired Health, who's from the Boston Children's Hospital. But she thinks it's all going to be okay because of gene editing and genome sequencing. So don't panic.
Actually, that we should also say that our new issue's out now.
Yes.
And it's the end of the world issue, to go on Liat's point about diseases. And what we actually do in the magazine is we meet some pioneers who are trying to protect humanity from certain apocalyptic events, including disease, war, nuclear fallout, asteroids, and if a leader gets to power who's particularly tyrannical.
Wonderful. I learned this week that, according to Pew Research, 34% of adults would be enthusiastic about using a chip to enhance their brains.
I'd use that.
So the age of cyborgs will soon be upon us, or at least a third of us.
Although, what if they got hacked?
Well, Matt Burgess. No, we'll get to that in a minute. Vicky, what did you learn this week?
Well, I actually learned that although the word quite has become to widely mean something that, you know, it's okay, a little bit, so like, oh, that was quite good. It actually stems from a Latin word that meant wholly or entirely, and it was used to describe something that was completely and thoroughly brilliant.
You said this the other day in the office, and I was thinking about it. So it must still be used somewhere, and it is, by incredibly posh people, and they go, quite!
Yes.
Which means exactly, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah, whereas I go, oh, it's quite interesting, but you might go, oh, quite.
I mean, Burgess is quite funny.
I don't know which way to take that.
It's almost certainly an insult. Who are we starting with? Whose story's first? Matt Burgess, it's you with your hotel hacks.
So do we all know what ransomware is? Would anybody like a description of ransomware?
I think you should probably give a bit of an update.
Okay, so if anybody doesn't know what ransomware is, it is basically some code that can be put on a computer in the form of through a virus or malware or other types of nasty computer virus-y type things. And it will lock your computer and you can't use your computer again until you pay somebody a fee or pay somebody probably to get it fixed in a very expensive way. So, James, I could lock your computer and say, I want 10,000 hamburgers or something. Please pay me these. And
you're not getting me, Hamburger Harry.
Hamburger Harry the hacker.
So ransomware is very good for sensational headlines because it's quite evocative, the idea of being locked out of something and having to pay a ransom to get back into it. And a few weeks ago, or a little while ago, there was a story that broke about a hotel that had been ransomwared.
Yes, so that was actually the beginning of this week, but the ransomware hit the hotel, I think, at the beginning of the ski season. So the hotel is called the Romantic Sea Hotel Jägerwit. That's the first time I've said that.
Sounds about right.
Okay, and it's in Austria, and it's got a four-star hotel. Rooms are £300 a night. It looks over some mountains and scenery and a lake, and it's really just a very nice hotel. But the reports this week were saying that the hotel had been hit by ransomware and guests had been locked out or locked in of their rooms.
So all the doors stopped working. They were all bolted shut by this nasty bit of computer code, and everyone was very scared because these people couldn't get in or out of their rooms. Sounds awful, but...
Yeah, that was the theory in the first reports of it, but in reality, that's not really happened. So there was a couple of inaccuracies in the initial reports, which spread widely, as these sort of things do on the internet.
Fake news.
You're fake news.
You're all fake news. Sorry, Matt. Sorry. Carry on, we took you off your stride.
I think that it's a case of, it's not really fake news, it may have just been a genuine error that's been lost in translation somewhere, but the news was, or the incorrect news was, that it was locking all these doors. But basically the hotel owners have since come out to say, we did get hit by ransomware, but people weren't locked in and out of rooms. The problem was the computer that produces the key cards, the sort of magnetic cards, when you go in, you put them in, you try about six times and it doesn't work, and then you go back to reception, then come back and it eventually works.
Always.
But that computer had been hit by ransomware, so they couldn't make any new cards, so people probably couldn't get into some rooms, mm-hmm. although there's manual overrides as well, I would imagine, in a lot of cases.
Yes.
But that was the actual what happened here, and that's like a very common thing.
But the cynic in me, just to pause you, would say, oh, well, that's what the hotel wants you to think. Whereas actually these poor darling guests were stuck in their hotel rooms. But having spoken to security experts and experts in locks to a degree, turns out, nah, this really couldn't happen.
Yeah, so I think if you just take it on from a purely logical perspective, when you go to a hotel and your card doesn't work, or you've had it maybe next to your credit card or something like that, there's the theory of, or the concept of, card clash that happens. So these mm-hmm. cards quite often have magnetic strips in. When they're close to other ones, they can be lose their basically coding, or what's not inside the cards, but what they're intended to do. So they're not like connected to any sort of internet connection.
They're just a dumb bit of plastic, pretty
much. Yeah, doors aren't connected either. There are some hotels that have Bluetooth doors now and sort of RFID and sort of wireless doors, but they still have some sort of ways to access. But if you just think about the standard hotel door, you can go in and come out. And
I often think about the standard hotel door.
But if you're inside a room as well, you can't... The door isn't going to rely on a computer or electronics to let you out. If there's a fire, there still needs to be some sort of way. So that's just like quite clearly.
Yeah, there's a failsafe, there's a backup. There's always a backup with bits of physical infrastructure like this. But it still did cause some disruption. It cost them about 1,500 euros in Bitcoin that they had to pay. But that was only to get the computer that makes the magnetic cards work on individual doors to work again, so that they could issue new key cards and start running the hotel again, right?
Yeah, and that's what happened. And they said it's the fourth time that this has happened, or around the fourth time. That's probably because they keep paying up. But I guess that it is a case of if they do pay, then they're going to be hit again. And there probably are other ways around it. But these sort of doors aren't smart, they aren't intelligent. And they've actually said that they're going to replace all the magnetic cards and stuff with physical keys again.
Oh, going back to the keys. But the thing is, though, the whole idea of a hotel being hacked, is this something that actually happens quite regularly?
Yeah, it is actually. Like pretty much anything that is connected to the internet or has computers or devices, it can be hit by a cyber attack or hackers or anybody with malicious intent. So hospitals, universities have been hit by ransomware and they've paid up. Hospitals is particularly worrying in the cases of there's people in there that rely on machines to be alive. But other hotels have also been hit by different types of cyber attacks, including malware attacks to steal customers' data. Donald Trump's hotels have been hit a couple of times. I think there was a period for more than a year between May 2014 and June 2015 where their point of sale terminals and their computer systems that handle customer details were infected with malware that was potentially, it wasn't confirmed, but stealing customers' details.
So. And there's been a few instances where security research has shown that hotel Wi-Fi networks are being compromised. Because if you know that you're targeting a very expensive hotel, you're going to have a certain kind of guest there. And if you sit hiding on that network waiting for an executive of a certain business to check in, someone from a certain country's, I don't know, government to come along, then bingo, you've got them.
Easy picking.
Yeah, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. So hotels are an obvious target for these kind of things. And in this instance, it made the attackers 1,500 euros, which is okay for probably not much work.
But I mean, at Wired Security last year, we had Monte Cristo talking to us about his job, or part of his job is to actually negotiate with these ransomware hackers, to find ways to try and convince them to allow... To let up from taking control of the computer. And he concentrates on really big corporate businesses because obviously they are going to be under attack. But it just goes to show that this is the kind of thing that's going to become even more common.
One of the great pleasures of working for Wired is that we can have very serious stories like that, but then within minutes we can be researching my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents. Probably a few more greats in there.
Probably quite a lot more.
Turns out they didn't have an anus.
So, no offence, but your oldest ancestor, James, was a sack-like bag of skin and muscles that ate and excreted from the same hole.
Aren't we all?
That just means we used to be an awful lot more efficient.
We didn't.
In my book.
So, I joke, but it's not just James's ancestor, though. This weird sea-dwelling creature is actually believed to be the oldest ancestor in the group of animals that include us.
The eldest known.
Eldest known creature.
So we're going back a long, 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 long way.
So it's actually believed that the creatures lived in water around 540 million years ago. The tiny fossilised creatures that lived during the early Cambrian period, they were found in China and they're less than 1.2 millimetres long. They have pleated circular mouths and up to 8 openings along their bizarre bodies. So the study was published by Simon Conway from the University of Cambridge, and he describes the small animals as having bag-like bodies with prominent mouths and 4 conical openings on either side.
Just, this is really not the point, but did they have a name? Did they give it, like, did they call it James, or did they?
Thanks, Matt.
Hamburger Harry. They do have a name. It's a long Latin name that I'm not even going to attempt to try and pronounce.
I don't totally understand the 4 mouths. 4 conical openings, shall I say.
So... the mouth, they had. If you look at the pictures online, and it does look like something that someone would draw, sort of like an alien or
to
something.
To terrify small children.
Yeah, exactly. So they had a main mouth that was disproportionately large for the creature size. So they thought it could have probably eaten other creatures. Then the smaller openings, they wouldn't have been used for breathing, as you may think, but they may have eventually evolved into what we know as gill slits now in modern water dwellers. Unusually, though, the animals appear to have had no anus, like James alluded to earlier. So the openings may have been used to both feed and excrete water and waste. But the reason why we think that they're part of the group that contains us, there's lots of various reasons, but one of the things is that the creature's body was symmetrical, and that's a trait actually seen in its evolutionary descendants, like including us.
Mm-hmm. I remember there was a really, really fascinating documentary on the BBC a couple of years ago. Its name escapes me. But they used very, very high-resolution scanning to show... a baby growing in the womb from the very, very earliest stages, so when it's a zygote or whatever the correct technical term is. And you can see this thing that looks a bit like a peanut almost, and it's the face folds in, and it explained that when a child is born with a cleft palate, it's because those two bits that grow round, and it's the same in fish, it's the same in any animal that's symmetrical, which is, I guess, all of them, right? That it comes round, and you get a cleft palate when one side gets there too soon. Or they come across at slightly the wrong angle. So the bit here, what's it called? A philtrum? Fulcrum?
Fulcrum.
The bit in between your nose and your lip. That is the bit where your face meets. So that is the symmetry that goes all the way back to the sack-like anusless blob.
That little bit there on our mouths, everyone touch it.
Yep.
That used to be a sack-like creature with no anus.
It's really cool.
And, I think it's really cool.
And they also found that it had other kind of little traits that are... that we'd associate as being animal-like, even though it's so, so small. So it could move using muscles. It had skin.
And it used those muscles to wiggle. And I always imagine it's a bit like a stingray. The way that the stingray sort of moves through the water, I just imagine it doing that with its massive mouth, trying to eat everything and then pooing.
I love how you say you've always imagined. Like, this has just imagined. Haunted your dreams.
When I'm not thinking about hotel doors, this is what I'm thinking about.
And the other amazing part of this, so I think it was discovered in some shale fields in Canada where there's an awful lot of fossils from this very, very early, was it the Cumbrian period?
Yeah.
Was that it's so small that they didn't think they'd ever find fossilised remains of something this minuscule. And it really is tiny. It's almost bacteria.
Yeah.
But it's a creature with DNA. It's an animal.
And they actually found another creature that was exactly that. It was so tiny that they thought it was... It's not so much that they never thought they'd find fossils. They just thought that something that small wouldn't physically be able to fossilise because it's so tiny, it wouldn't be able to sort of form the fossil. So that's really... It's really interesting. Also, the fact that... How could you be in those shale fields and just go, hang on, this is creature,
it's just a bit of sand.
Like, that blows my mind.
They must just scoop buckets up and pay some poor intern to...
They have been, and research science has been going on in these shale fields in the Rocky Mountains in Canada for decades and decades and decades, so they must go over it almost literally with a fine-tooth comb. So from hotel hacks to anus sac things to, I mean, this is a really, really remarkable story, Liat. Locked-in syndrome. We've written about it a lot in Wired. We've done some features on some of the amazing sort of tech health crossovers, and this week there was a big breakthrough, but for people with completely locked in syndrome, which is an even more severe form of the condition.
Yeah, and it's kind of, as it's described, as the terminology describes it, they can't even move their eye muscles, which in a lot of cases is how people with locked in syndrome or tetraplegic people communicate.
So you blink or wink.
Yeah, or you're looking, you're tracking something on a screen and selecting words that way. So, I mean, as James said, we've written about brain-computer interfaces, which is these hacks to try and help these individuals communicate. There's been, we did a massive feature on BrainGate, which is one end of the spectrum where they're actually able to pick up things with robotic prosthetics, which is absolutely immense, but it's kind of a lot more complex in terms of you have to have an implant in your brain. Something's come out this week which is just so unbelievably remarkable. I'm kind of shaking a bit thinking about it. I'm also starving, so there's that. But it's completely non-invasive using EEGs and another bit of technology I'll tell you about later to let these individuals communicate yes or no answers. Never been done before. People didn't even think it was possible because of the degree to which they are incapable of movement.
So just to underline this and put it in italics and highlight it red, this is the first time that people with completely locked-in syndrome have been able to communicate in any way.
Yeah. Shed a tear over that.
And that's the thing, like, although you say, oh, they were able to answer yes or no questions, this is huge.
This is epic. This is absolutely amazing. And I can't, it's one of these things you, I mean, I love these people. I want to go and shake their hands and in what, the Weiss Centre in Geneva.
Before we get into the details, yeah. and this almost brought a tear to my eye, and I'm sure an awful lot of people reading it, what did people say when they were able to communicate for the first time?
Well, the thing that has made headlines everywhere, because I think it's something everybody, when you read a story about someone with locked-in syndrome and it breaks your heart, you know, what is their quality of life? And every single one of the people, there were only four, but it made it sound like there were 100, over a period of weeks repeatedly said, are you happy? They said yes. So they were, this question was put to them over and over again over a period of several weeks throughout the study, and they kept saying yes. So
which for their families and their carers must be...
Yeah, it's immense. Just, it's like immeasurable, the kind of...
It actually gives me goosebumps.
Joy you can
like
bring
to people.
Proper
goosebumps.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously they can't ask complex questions, and we don't know all the questions they put to them. So in that moment when you're communicating with your friends and family and you're able to communicate for the first time, I'm sure you know that you're happy. I don't know how much they went into what's your Monday like, what's your Tuesday like, how have you been the last few years. I don't know how in-depth it went, but to just have that human connection back,
it's unimaginable. It's a start, and it's a remarkable
start. It's incredible.
There's one of the questions that they asked him was talking about to some fathers in the group.
Oh, this was amazing.
I love this bit.
I couldn't actually find it in the paper, but it was in the press release, which I found it because they must have just loved this as an anecdote to share. You know, they asked them, is this your husband? Yes, wife, yes. Family members to, you know, verify the system and practice. One guy got asked repeatedly, should his daughter marry her boyfriend, Mario? I don't know if that's his real name. No, 9 times out of 10. The answer is no. She might not be laughing about this, but...
Was the 10th time a yes? Because it's just like, can you just stop asking me? Fine.
I mean, he could have been aiming for comedy. He might really not like Mario. Who knows what's going on? But
so the reason that they were asking, not the marriage question, but is this your wife? Is this your father?
Yeah, obviously to verify if this works, if this system worked. And overall, the success rate or the accuracy rate was 70%, which they said was, you know, kind of above average enough to say that this is working.
So let's get into the details of it. This was carried out by the WIS Centre for Bio and Neuroengineering in Geneva. But how does it actually work? What was their technique? What was their method?
Right, because they needed to kind of... Well, I kind of described it as like a two-step authentication.
I did enjoy that.
They probably would not. because, you know, they can't track eye movements. They approach it from a different angle, which is to use EEGs to measure electrical signals in the brain.
So this is a cap that goes on your skull with sensors.
Yes, and it's got electrodes and you're measuring where the brain activity is and, you know, looking at those patterns if, you know, yes is the correct answer and this particular area keeps lighting up for yes, then you can deduce that means yes. But to basically as a check on this and to better understand what was happening, they used something called near infrared spectroscopy.
Spectroscopy.
Yeah, I keep trying to do both pronunciations at the same time. So this uses light to measure oxygen levels in the blood, and obviously there's more oxygen going to regions of the brain that are being used more at that particular moment. So that's how they've done it, and it's literally with a cap on their head.
And systems like this,
so
it was, with four people, as you say, it's completely non-invasive, but it takes a lot of training to be able to get the brain and the patient to behave in a way that gets the right responses.
Well, I mean, yes, I can. So it was something like 47 sessions. Mm. Two of the people did 47 sessions. Three did 47 and one did 20. But it was only over a period of a few weeks. Mm-hmm. So although, yes, it's probably very intense for them, you know, being able to communicate after a couple of weeks.
The payoff's pretty good.
Immense, yeah. And, I mean, yeah, it's just remarkable that that's something you can do in 3 weeks. Who knows where we'll be in 3 years? And that's really the aim of this, is to make it so that they can build a technology you can put in these people's homes and they can communicate about their care, about their feelings, about what they want right now and have some sense of autonomy.
And even the researchers working on it, which is kind of bizarre to my mind, didn't think it would work.
Yeah, I thought this was pretty remarkable. The lead professor on the paper basically said how shocked he was, and he thought that these individuals didn't have the capacity to formulate answers in their brain. These are motor neuron diseases, you know, everything's shutting down, and so we have no way of knowing up until now what kind of functions, what kind of brain capacity was remaining in terms of formulating language and concepts.
Yeah, so what's next? This was a very, very small study on four people. It took, while not a lot of work, it took quite a bit of work. I guess the idea is that it might be useful to patients that are living at home or in care or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they basically, in the paper, they say that this is the first step towards abolition of complete locked-in states, at least for ALS. This was specifically for people with this disorder, but they want to try it with, you know, different disorders, paralyzed individuals, tetraplegics, and make sure that they use the term clinically useful, you know, to actually have a tool. We see all these studies, but obviously it's a very small number of people that are being part of these incredible leaps in our understanding and our technology. So obviously, the ideal is that this can be brought to everyone and really improve everyone's quality of life.
And you get the impression that that first flash, that first answer that came back is going to be probably one of those moments in medical science that we'll look back on in a few years when potentially we're able to communicate with people with completely locked-in syndromes in far more advanced ways, just as people with partial locked-in syndrome, whatever the correct term would be, we thought, well, there's no way.
Exactly.
And those people have written novels.
Yeah, that would be immense. That would be wonderful. And you know, I think everyone's hoping for that kind of future. We wouldn't have thought this kind of... Well, I was looking back at the history of brain interface technology.
As you do.
Brain-computer interface. Because I just remember writing about this in the early days at Wired, and there was a story even from 2005 of people using brain-computer interfaces to walk around VR simulations. And this technology has just been growing and growing. And yeah, you know, if we can all be cyborgs one day, I think this is totally doable.
At this point, we'll say goodbye to Vicky and Leah and welcome João Medeiros, Wired's science editor, to the show. João, we've got an event coming up in a few weeks, which you've been doing all the work on.
Yes, I have.
Tell us a bit about that.
So the event that's coming up, it's Wired Health. It's going to be the fourth edition, and we're going to have amazing speakers this year. We have Dame Sally Davis, the Chief Medical Officer for England. We have Jessica Mega, the CTO for Verily, Alphabet's medical arm. Mm-hmm. We have Jeremy Freeman. He's the Science Director for the Shen Zuckerberg Initiative, who has just dedicated $1 billion to cure all disease.
Small goals.
Small goals. No, moonshots or marshots.
Yeah.
They call it. There's also Peter Pyatt, who spoke last year at the main event, one of the discoverers of the Ebola virus and HIV. It's an incredible lineup.
So these are people that are working at the very front line of healthcare and medical innovation, but it's stuff that's happening right now as well as things that they're working towards.
Yeah, so it really reflects Wired's editorial coverage in the sense that we're looking for the future that as it happens now. Mm-hmm. So people working at the forefront of medicine, inventing treatments that, you know, they're not just blueprints of what can be, but things that actually can be applied right now. So one of the examples which I wrote about in the last issue is Guardant Health, who've developed liquid biopsies for cancer. So blood test that can replace the standard biopsy. So that's a crucial example of how these new technologies can enhance treatments and provide cures more widely right now.
And it really brings the magazine to life. It's a fascinating day. It's an all-day event, 9th of March at 30 Euston Square in London. People can find out more by going to wired.co.uk and clicking on events. Now, one of the features that you mentioned there is in the current issue of Wired, which came out today. We're recording this on Thursday. It's got a very striking cover on the front of the magazine where we proclaim the end of the world. But the feature that you wrote, which you just mentioned, is somewhat more hopeful, and it's about this amazing work around detection and management of cancer. So tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, it's not it's not the end of the world. It's a very positive feature about striking a breakthrough in how we manage and treat and detect cancer, essentially. So Guardant Health, as I mentioned, the CEO is a man called Elmi El-Khulti, who used to work for Illumina, so one of the biggest manufacturers of DNA sequencers in the world. And what Elmi has developed along with his team is a method of detecting cancer cells in the bloodstream. By doing that, you can actually substitute what would be a painful, expensive, and complicated tissue biopsy. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about a lung biopsy, that's a very dangerous procedure.
These are procedures that can kill or certainly badly harm a patient and slow down their recovery.
Indeed, yes.
How are they actually how are they doing this detection? Is it different to what other people are doing as well?
There are some companies now that are using liquid biopsies. They are, I think, the pioneers in terms of bringing this technology to market. So actually, there was a lot of this coming from academia. In this case, a man called Maurice Strawn was a plant physiologist, and he was the first one to discover cancer, DNA cancer cells in the bloodstream, or of frogs in this case.
So what they were actually noticing, that there was extra DNA in the blood of cancer patients?
So if you think about it, you know, if a patient has a tumor, what happens to the tumor as it grows, the rate of expansion can be very high, or growth of the tumor can be high, but the date of death is also high. So there's a lot of cells dying and shedding their contents into the bloodstream. And part of the contents of the cell is the DNA itself. Now, we're talking about the bloodstream, so it was very difficult to detect these DNA molecules, purely because there'll be, you know, not many in terms of all the stuff that's in the blood. So, but these guys have developed a new sequencing technique called digital sequencing, mm-hmm. whereby their precision and accuracy in terms of picking up a needle in a haystack, as it is, it's incredible. So the moment they can detect one, I mean, they have no false positives when it comes to detecting DNA.
So the accuracy is something like 99.99999%, it's not literally a needle in a haystack, but figuratively it is. You're looking for just a couple of cells.
Yeah, I mean, so other tests might have false positives, so you might detect a certain gene that actually is not there. It's just, you know, it comes from the noise in the sequencing itself. But these guys, if they have detected one cell, they know for sure that the cancer is there.
Right? Yeah, and what makes this really, like, really exciting for me as well is that am I right in thinking that this new procedure will actually bring down the cost of biopsies by a huge amount?
Yeah, I mean, a blood test doesn't cost much. So you're replacing, and you know, tissue biopsies are, like I said, expensive, and you know, but if you have access to a top hospital, you'll probably be fine. You know, it's still a very complicated procedure in surgery. For most people, don't have access to that level of hospital care. With blood tests, all you need is to send a blood draw. You need a nurse and FedEx, basically, and you can have the results of your tests wherever you are in the world. So it does democratize the biopsy of cancers, and gives people more information about what cancer they have, what sort of mutations they have, and essentially what kind of treatment they should be receiving.
A really interesting part of the feature in the story of the people that you speak to is that they don't talk about curing cancer, or not in the short term anyway. It's about managing the disease and almost treating it as if you were treating HIV, which is not often what people talk about. They talk about finding a cure for cancer. This is a more grounded approach, and they've seen some really good results through managing the disease.
So I think the mechanics of it is that if you detect the mutation of the cancer, then you can select a treatment that targets that particular mutation, right? So you neutralize the cancer as it is, or the cancer might at some point dissolve or disappear. But what happens is that when you strike the cancer with a certain treatment, you're forcing the cancer to mutate. And that's when you have, you know, what they call the landscape of resistance. So as the cancer resists, it mutates and becomes something else, which the original treatment no longer can target because it's a different mutation. Now, these guys, what they can do with the blood test is to follow all the mutations and, you know, track that sort of evolution within the cancer, and you can have, you know, repeated treatments which are targeting all the different mutations as they evolve.
And they'll be collecting vast amounts of data which allow them to better understand how cancer mutates and evolves, and so they can get ahead in this cat and mouse game and prescribe the right drugs at the right time to the right patients.
In theory, yes. In theory, they because of blood tests, they can continuously track how the disease evolves.
So it's a remakable story. It really is.
It gives a lot of people a lot of hope.
And opens up that treatment to an awful lot more people as well. We're talking many, many orders of magnitude cheaper and safer to get this kind of treatment, which is a huge deal.
Yeah, when I visited the company, or they're based in California, they have a meeting every week where they go, where they talk about several case studies. And a lot of this is quite striking because you're really talking about people, bringing people from you know, very, very critical conditions where they're already being sent home, you know, and expect to die in a few weeks, to actually people being brought back from the death as it is, because they even, I mean, the other thing with this test is sometimes a standard biopsy does not detect a mutation. Because you have a tumor, and if your biopsy only hits part of that tumor, you might miss different mutations in the other part of the tumor.
Yeah.
And with this, you can get all the landscape of mutations of the cancer, so you're getting everything, really.
And it's quite cross-disciplinary as well. You've got lots of different people from lots of different institutions working together on this, and it's based in California. You've got people coming from all over the world, so at a time when maybe the US is looking a little bit more isolationist, it's a really, really great example of how important collaboration is for science and for making these huge breakthroughs. It needs to go across borders.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, it is one of those examples of innovation coming from California, from, you know, a very different sort of people from very different backgrounds in that company, scientifically and nationally, and how they're bringing up an innovation that's crucial in terms of medicine and terms of how you treat people.
So the feature is Lifeblood. It is in the March 2017 issue of Wire magazine, which is out now. And you can hear lots more stories like that and meet some really amazing people at Wired Health in a few weeks' time. Joao, thanks very much for coming on to tell us all about that. And sure, that will do it for the podcast this week. We'll see you again next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.